This week on Two Legs, we have a new Record Store Day release from Paul. It is called Home Tonight and In a Hurry. We're going to be checking that out. And also, the new Ringo version of Grow Old With Me featuring Paul playing bass also dropped this week also. And we're going to be tackling that as well.
And we've got Adrian Allen, author of Paul McCartney After the Beatles. Stay tuned. Hi, McCartney fans, and welcome to another episode of Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. I am one of your two co-hosts, Tom Hunyadi. We are a Paul McCartney talk show, mainly dealing with Paul's solo career. As always, I am joined by my co-host and partner in crime, Andy Nichols. Andy, what's going on, my friend?
Afternoon, gentlemen. Adrian, thanks for joining us, and how's it hanging?
It's hanging all right.
All right.
As we mentioned in our little intro, we have Adrian Allen here. He is the author of Paul McCartney After the Beatles, A Musical Appreciation. We're going to be talking about that in 1 second. But first, the news, two big news items that happened this week. We got a new, they premiered the new Ringo song, Grow Old With Me, which was written by John Lennon. And I believe this was produced by Jack Douglas, who worked on the original with John. So Adrian, you said you've listened to the song, and what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought first I was a little bit disappointed because there was a bit of auto tune in it, and
right.
Also thought he chose quite a low key as well. Well, actually, I was comparing another version. If anybody out there wants to listen on YouTube, there's one by Billy Kingsley, who was the lead singer in a group called the Merseybeats, a very famous 60s band. He also went on to play in Liverpool Express. I think it's really good to compare his version of it as well. He sings in a higher key, and I think myself and a few other people agreed it was more expressive in a higher key. On the good side, I do think McCartney's bass playing is quite tasteful in it, quite like that. And as a few people commented, it's a pity we can't hear more of Paul's harmony vocals as well. It seems to have got lost in the mix a bit.
Yeah, it was buried, and I don't know. I didn't really know what to expect. I know they worked on the song "Walk with You" or "Walk with Me," and Paul's vocals was definitely right up there along with Ringo's. But yeah, I was kind of surprised a bit by the by Paul's vocals being buried as much as they were. And and I think the bass playing was fine, but anytime that Ringo does one of these slower ballady type songs, I always kind of worry how he's going to do it, because I never feel like his singing voice or his vocals are strong. He's more of a rock and roll singer, in my opinion. He's not really more of a balladeer type style singer. So I was a little disappointed with the vocals as well. But Andy, what were your thoughts?
I enjoyed it for what it was. The auto-tune was there. Auto-tune is prevalent in just about any kind of song now, especially by singers in their 70s and 80s. But I enjoyed the production of it. The bass mix is obviously very prominent in it. There was a cool little thing I did read online. It seems like we've got a case of kind of history being rewritten to suit what's going on now, a narrative. I don't know if any of you guys have seen it, but apparently Ringo thinks that this recording was actually just tailor-made for him, because the tape he was given has John speaking before it, saying this is going to be for Ringo. But that's not actually the case. That was a demo that he had done For Nobody Told Me, which he intended to give to Ringo, okay. And that was going to be for Ringo. I don't know if Jack Douglas just cut it up to make it suit Ringo's and have him have, but that's being put out there as actually John wrote this for Ringo. That's actually not really the case, and I don't know if any of you two have heard that or seen that, but I'd noticed that since it released, that's kind of been put out there that this is John specifically did this for Ringo. It's actually an actual fact. That's not the case.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Also, we have another bit of news, and Paul McCartney is participating in the second edition of 2009 Record Store Day once again. He's releasing a 7-inch pincer disc single of two songs that were from the Egypt Station sessions called Home Tonight and In a Hurry. So kind of curious to hear these. And Adrian, what were your thoughts on Egypt Station as a whole?
I thought it had some nice bits in it. I liked I Don't Know. I thought that was like a classic sort of McCartney song. And I did like some of the other songs. I've got to be honest and just say that his voice is now one of the main attractions they used to listen to McCartney. He had one of the best voices in pop music. And I just think now he's lost that expressive range. It's just a bit disappointing to listen to sometimes. And if I'm really honest, there were a few songs I liked in it, but I always go back to the older stuff. It's a bit controversial on some of these Facebook pages where a lot of people think, oh, he should just go on as long as he can. I really hope that now he's going to focus on writing songs for other young performers to perform. And I'm optimistic he's going to come out because he's writing songs for musical now, isn't he? And I'm hoping that's going to be a real success. There were some nice moments on it. And one thing I want to ask about this release, the picture disc of it. Does anybody know whether he's painted those pictures on the picture disc? Because they look very much in his style.
Yeah, I think this was announced on his Paul McCartney website, but I didn't actually read the detail yet, so I'm not 100% sure if this was an actual McCartney painting or not.
If I had to guess, since he did the artwork for Egypt Station, I was sure that the artwork on the picture disc is probably by him because it suits the whole theme of what he's been going for. If there's ever been an album that has been, commercialized and sold, I mean, and milked, I mean, the album came out in September of 2018, and we've had Get Enough, we've had all these other tracks drop, Frank Sinatra's Party, all these songs, and now even over a year later, he was still milking it, but I hope they're good. I hope they're good tracks. My gut tells me that they're going to be, but we'll see.
Yeah, I've noticed some people, they're talking about how, these are just leftover tracks that they didn't make it on the album. So why release these songs? But to those people, I say, The Mess, I Lie Around, I'll Give You a Ring, Flying to My Home. I mean, all those songs didn't make albums. And we all think that they're, great McCartney classics. However, they just didn't, make the album. Big Boy's Biggering, Long Leather Coat. Again, two songs that people really enjoy that didn't make the album. And we sometimes, give him crap for, his song selections when his albums. Because normally in his sessions, he usually does record enough stuff for a double album a lot of the times. So he's always got this wealth of music. So I'm kind of curious about these songs as well. So looking forward. Do you have a Record Store Day out there, right, Adrian?
A record store, did you say?
No, Record Store Day. It's a day where they just sell these particular albums.
Is that an online thing or is it physical?
No, it's a
real thing. Record Store Day was initiated over about 10 years ago to promote brick and mortar stores. Because people were buying so much music online, they saw that traditional record shops were closing, and this program was put together to kind of get people out actually going to stores and buying real records from a real store. So now all these artists have kind of released, albums that are only released on Record Store Day, and it's been quite successful. McCartney's released a few titles on Record Store Day.
Yeah,
I know a couple of years ago he released a 12-inch of Maybe I'm Amazed from Wings Over America, which was pretty scarce to get.
Yeah,
so
he's done
a few things. He did last year. He did the he did a single release, a vinyl only release, I think, for I Don't Know and Come On to Me from Egypt Station.
Correct.
So it's I don't
Yeah.
I thought it was in the UK too, but I guess apparently it's only in
If it,
America.
you know what, there aren't even many record shops left in the UK. I live
Really?
in what? I live in the third biggest city in Britain, which is Manchester, and I
Okay.
can think of the two biggest record shops. You've got something called HMV, which was in the centre of Manchester, that closed a couple of years ago, and we had
Okay.
one in a big retail park called the Trafford Centre, that closed about 2 years ago as well. So I'm sad to say, it's just nearly all online now, and that's just how it is.
Really? Well, it is more of an independent record store day thing as well. I mean, they really don't. I mean, the big chains really don't participate in this. They just mainly keep it to the smaller, mom and
Mom and
pop
pop
style
stores.
shop. Yeah, exactly. So it's something that my wife and I we enjoy. We usually are first in line. We get to our local record store at like 2 in the morning. We camp out there until the shop opens at 9 o'clock, and we're, like I said, we're usually in first in line so we can get, the stuff that on. So, and also these releases, Adrian, they're also limited. They could be 500 copies all the way up to 12,000 copies, like this McCartney disc is going to be. So, but I'm sure a lot of people will find them on eBay and stuff like that,
Yeah, they'll just go on eBay and you'll have to pay about, $1,000 or, $1,000, for it.
So, anyways, okay, so that's the news part of it. So, Adrian, once again, I want to thank you for. I know we had a little bit of technical difficulty the first time, and I really appreciate you making the time to, reschedule for this. So, thank you once again. And we're here to talk about this guy right here. This is Paul McCartney, After the Beatles, A Musical Appreciation. Before we get into that, Adrian, why don't you, talk about yourself a little bit, and then. After that, tell us about becoming a fan of McCartney's solo career.
Well, actually, I used to go to my grandmother's house in the early set then, because still had cassettes called The Beatles Ballads. I don't know if you remember that album. It's a compilation album which we used to listen to. It had the famous one of the famous pictures by Alan, is it Alan Alberg or someone, one of the famous Beatles artists. It's got a lovely picture on the cover of it. And I used to listen to that. I'm just a hooked and I love the music. And then a bit later, we got the cassette off Give My Regards to Broad Street, which is a record now, which is panned a lot, but I love that. And
Me
after what
too.
happened then is once I got into that, like a lot of Beatles fans, I started collecting all of the Beatles records. And then after I got all the Beatles records, when I started exploring his solo career, and I got more into his solo career, legs and all. Probably the same path that you two have been down. You start off with the general stuff about the Beatles, and then you, and it was, I collected all the John Lennon stuff as well. But it was Paul McCartney's melodic sense and his harmonic style, which I really fell in love with, I suppose. And so I've been collecting and listening to his music now, probably for about 35 years, something like that.
What was some of the first songs that got you interested into his solo career besides listening to Give My Regards to Broad Street soundtrack?
I think when one of the other early things I got a long time ago was the Wings Greatest Hits album, and I really envy people who've never heard these songs before, because just listening to them the first time has been an amazing experience. So songs like My Love obviously stood out on that, and then there's obviously all the classics like Maybe I'm a songs which weren't on that album, like On Ram, things like Backstreet Off My Car. And Backseat of My Car, and also I think was on Wings Greatest Hits was Uncle Albert as well, which is another great song. So, and then you don't discover things which weren't really that famous. One I mentioned in the book quite a lot is Love and So in Song, which is on Venus and Mars, which is also a great song, but isn't really that well known. And then you listen to some of the bootleg things. I don't know if you remember when Cole 88. I remember buying the CD of it. Actually, it was vinyl at the time because CDs didn't start coming out on bootlegs for a few years later. And it's great. There were some great songs on that, like Did We Meet Somewhere Before? Which I've been looking at because I will be doing a book tour as well. So I've started looking at Did We Meet Somewhere Before? Because it's got a great clarinet introduction on it. And then it's got same time next year. You know, all things like same time next year, all these obscure songs, which are really great and would have been hits for any other artist, really. No, but so there's so much to discover there. There are hundreds of songs to discover, and that's a journey I went on.
Right. You mentioned you collected John's stuff as well. What did you think of John's solo career while you were discovering all this music?
I mean, right. So when I started collecting the John stuff, it was just about the time when the Lost Lennon tapes came out. That would be about 1987 or something like that. I remember the radio series in America. So they started releasing all the bootleg CDs of that. And I liked Walls and Bridges as an album. Thought that was really good. And Mind Games, maybe less so. I liked half of Double Fantasy. And you can guess which half. Half which I liked of Double Yeah. I mean, his solo output, obviously, it's nowhere near the size of McCartney's. And it's interesting to make comparisons. One obvious comparison a lot of people don't make is that I think on Lennon's solo career, you don't hear much in terms of vocal harmony. I can't think of that many songs where John Lennon's double-tracked his own three-part harmonies, which you hear all along the Wings solo career and ever since, really, in McCartney's career since Wings as well.
Right.
So I think that's a major difference.
Right. I mean, that's such a big part of Paul's sound throughout the 70s. And then, you know, it going into to the early to mid 80s. And yeah, and you're right. I mean, you find that a little lacking, you know, where in the Beatles, you know, you had that with John, George and Paul. But you know, that's, I think, one of the things, I mean, you made a good point. That's one of the things that's lacking from John's solo career.
Yeah, Lennon's solo output is his production. All the production in his music is very dense. You know, Mind Games is very dense, very, very muddied production on a lot of his records, which, thanks to the remixes, when his music was remixed so 10 or 15 years ago, it really did kind of brighten out a little bit. But in terms of comparison, you know, to Paul's production, you know, and his ability to kind of, you know, use harmony and stuff like that, it was very, very much night and day. But that's, again, what made them, you know, a great songwriting team.
Right, right. So then from being a fan of McCartney's, I mean, this is what inspired you to pick up a guitar, become a musician yourself?
Since maybe a few years before I started listening to McCartney. I started guitar lessons about the age of 9 or 10.
Okay.
And I was just, without showing off, I was naturally connected to the music, I think, and I made quite good progress fairly quickly on guitar. And but what happened is when I started getting into McCartney, I would start collecting the sheet music then. So over the years, I got loads of sheet music. And first of all, I started borrowing it from the library. And I borrowed a book called Paul McCartney, Composer Artist, from the library. And I borrowed it so many times, the book actually fell apart. And I had to go and apologize to the librarian that the book had fallen apart. Discovered that if anybody's got the book Composer Artist by Paul McCartney, the binding on it's very bad quality, so it's going to fall apart anyway. So it did inspire me to get better on the guitar. And one thing also, I don't know if either of you two play guitar, but in that book Composer Artist, it's got all of the bar chords. You know, you have to put a finger across all the frets. I remember looking at it and thinking, how on earth do you play that chord, putting your finger across all six strings and playing all these other fingers as well? So I got a lot better with the left hand on the guitar, really, by playing some of these complicated shapes, which were in some of these songbooks that I bought throughout the time. And since I've collected all the songbooks of McCartney, I've got them all now, and it's a useful starting point.
Gotcha. So let's dig into this bad boy. This was released. What is this? We're in October. Was this released in? September? Was it released?
July, actually.
July. Okay. Right.
Yeah.
So
July.
Right. So just to, for people that don't have this book yet, what is Paul McCartney after the Beatles?
What's it about?
Yes.
So basically what it is, and its design really is a musical insight into Paul McCartney's work after the Beatles. There have been a few biographies written about Paul McCartney, like Philip Norman's and a few other ones, but there haven't been many books which really dig into the musical side of it. So I thought that that button really needed to be written. There has been a couple of others. There's one called Paul McCartney's Songwriter, which came out in the late 80s, but that's a little bit flimsy in detail. And I thought, because I've got quite a knowledge of McCartney and a knowledge of music theory as well, I thought I was maybe had an advantage being able to write this book. But what I didn't want it to be was just a technical, boring book of all different keys and cadences and all technical music stuff. I thought I knew enough about Paul McCartney's life to try and relate his music to some of the life events which are happening. And I wanted to try and make it in an accessible way and to be able to explain to people what makes these songs great and what things to look out for when you listen to these songs. And I think a good analogy of it is that we can listen to Paul McCartney's music and enjoy it just in its own terms without understanding anything else. But the analogy I use is that if you've walked through a forest on the way to work, say, every day for a year or a few years, and you really like it, and you really like the nature and everything, then that's fine. You can appreciate it. But then one day, a tour guide or somebody who really understands the nature can say, well, look at that tree over there. Did you know that's a willow tree? And they normally live for 50 years. And this is the undergrowth. And can you see that bird over there? Did you realize that's a chaffinch and that's a blackbird? And some points now, it's all things that you've really maybe not understood before or not recognized in the music. And I just think when you listen out for these things, you just might be able to appreciate the music on a slightly different level and just make connections with it that you might not have really noticed before.
Gotcha. Andy?
Yeah, that's great. Great follow-up, too. I think also, too, you make some great points. I actually lived in Liverpool for a while, Adrian. I went to Liverpool Hope University, and I wrote a thesis on McCartney, kind of just like an anti-bias from the music publications at the time in the 70s, kind of attacking him. And that's kind of why a lot of his music was largely criticized, because of that sentiment of him breaking up the Beatles and so forth. But a lot of what you wrote about is really amazing. And one of the things I found amazing just looking at your book was your analysis of Mary Had a Little Lamb, which is a song that I've always liked. But outside of the basic kind of structure of it, it's very, very complex song, especially the latter third of that song. Now, I'm not a trained musician, but I knew that that song was much more to meets the eye of than the simple melody that exists in that song. And you pointed that out perfectly in your book. Can you care to explain and go into that detail a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, you know, the ironic thing about Mary Had a Little Lamb is you think a children's song would be very simple. And although the words are very simple musically, it's one of the most sophisticated songs he ever wrote. And in that last third of the song, he uses something called tritone substitution. And tritone substitution is a jazz technique when rather than using normal chords, it's about substituting chords which are above the chord that you'd normally use. And it creates this very wonderful sequence, which you'll hear. I have actually pinpointed in the book where we're going to put time codes in, I like to say, at 3 minutes 17, you'll hear this effect. I can't remember exactly where it is in the song, but when you listen to it and look at the time coding I've put down, you'll hear this run of tritone substitution chords, which I don't think he's used before, which is incredibly sophisticated if he's done it just out in chords like a 13 flat 9 and all these sort of jazz chords you wouldn't expect to hear in a normal pop song. So it's what you call something extremely sophisticated masquerading under a children's song. And that's why I always made a connection with it. But it's not just a children's song, this. There's something a lot deeper about it.
Much, much deeper in it. And I've always heard that in that song. But, you know, the masses will dismiss it because it's a standard nursery rhyme. But it's anything but that. If you actually just listen to it and listen to the structure of that song, as you have, you know, beautifully illustrated, and that's I've always heard that in that song, and it's nice that we actually have somebody who has recognized that, written about it, and now it's out there for actually other people to actually, oh, okay, this song is not as simple as one thinks. Let's actually look at it, and you did a great job of that. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Let's talk about song selection. I mean, there's what, 80 songs, I believe, in the book, was it? Were these the songs that you thought they were the most impressive throughout his solo career that you wanted to talk about the most?
Well, one of the songs which I often come back to is My Love, for example, which has got a lot of points of musical interest in it. If you want me to tell you some of the special effects which are used in that, I'm happy to do so.
Sure.
Please do.
So if we're looking at the song My Love, and I've got my guitar here to demonstrate, before the song actually starts, you notice there's like a sustained note from the orchestra. And that note is the nose of A. Now, if you hear the nose of A, you might think the next chord it's going to come is a chord of A or a chord of A minor or something like that. But what actually happens is that note of A leads into that chord, which is a dreamy chord of B flat major seven. Now, B flat major seven or any major seven chord have got this sort of dreamy association in music. Now, I don't know if, just to make another connection, I don't know if you're a fan of Barry Gibb and Barbra Streisand. Have you heard their album called
Guilty.
Guilty?
Yeah,
Have you heard?
absolutely. Yep.
Yeah, I mean,
I remember that being played a
Dreamy
lot in the
Ballads,
early
and
80s.
that's the album to listen to for Dreamy Ballads. And I don't know if you know the song What Kind of Fool, but that starts with a major seven. So that starts. Remember?
I sure do.
So it's like a run of major seven chords. So if you put a major seven chord in a piece of music, it's going to sound dreamy. So just from the first few notes of the song, he sets up this amazing atmosphere, and it's going to be something special. And now when he starts into it, he uses what you call a Lydian scale. Right? Now, normally in the key of B, we're starting off with a chord of B flat major. And you wouldn't normally have a note of E flat in that run up. That note there sounds a little bit off, that note of E. So he uses, now the Lydian scale is often used within a lot of sci-fi films and that sort of thing to create a sort of otherworldly experience, really. And I'm saying that by using this Lydian scale on a chord of B flat, he's almost communicating to the listener that he's found this love with Linda McCartney, because it's basically the first love song he wrote for her, or maybe "An Amaze Maybe" came first. But it's almost like saying that this love for her is something different, otherworldly, by using this Lydian scale. So you've got all of that. And that's just in the first bar of the music, really, So I've got not got any further parts. When it goes to a chord of D major nine. Now, that's what you call a secondary dominant chord. It's getting a bit technical now, but that chord of D major shouldn't really be in the key signature. It creates a moment of uplift. When it goes to G minor, so you've got all these little bits. You've got all these bits of. I've talked about tension and release. So apart from just the magic of a few opening notes, he's taken us rather than just having boring chords which stick to the normal key signature of that song, which actually does turn out to be F major. He's taken us on a few detours to different chords you don't normally expect. And it's all of these things which make the music interesting, and it gives it little peaks and troughs in the music as well. So you're not just listening to something on a level playing field, you're taking on an emotional journey to different places. And that's what the song is about to me. And by the time you get to the end of the first verse, only by the end of the first verse do we really know that we're in the key of F major. So this is another term I use in the book, it's called harmonic ambiguity. But you don't really know from the start of a song, you don't know where he's taking us. It's only when we get to the end of the verse that you know you've arrived somewhere. And when he arrives at F major, he's almost like saying, "This is my love." And it's like a statement of authority that he's arrived somewhere and we're finally in the home key after going through this magical journey in the first verse of the music. And it's the amazing way that the music unfolds in this way. So it starts off magical, it goes detours, it unfolds, and then finally takes us to back to finally we get to F major there, and we know we're grounded and we are somewhere. But it's just an amazing way the song progresses.
Wow, interesting.
Wow,
cool. Now, with this, when you're learning this, I mean, is this something that's considered easy to learn, or I mean, is this difficult to learn? I mean, where in the scale of difficulty, I mean, would an up and comer that's, you know, wanting to learn acoustic guitar, I mean, where would this, you know, range for them to learn?
If anybody's interested in analyzing music in that way, you've got to start thinking in terms of not just chords, but the relationship of chords to the key signature. For example, when you're in the key of F major, F is key is the first chord of the key, and then the fourth chord of the key is B flat, and the fifth chord of the key is C. Right, so we're talking about chords 1, 4, and 1, right. Chord 4, and chord 5. You've got to start thinking along those levels rather than just F okay. major, B flat major, and C major. And gotcha. When you're thinking along those levels, you're making connections between other key signatures, because you could play the song My Love in a different key signature, and the connection between the chords will still be the same. It's just you've taken it to a different key signature. So when I'm looking at songs now, I'm not thinking there's a chord of F, or a C. I'm more thinking in terms of there's chord 1, which is the home key chord, there's chord 4, which we call a subdominant chord, and there's chord 5. And so I'm trying to apply that to different songs, really. But it's just a different way of thinking, really, and it does take a while to think along those levels. It's like learning a language, isn't it, really? And,
gotcha.
And I'm not saying I learned this overnight. Just many years of looking at music and making these connections. I'm not trying to say I'm not good, because jazz people, for example, know all this stuff easily.
Okay.
A jazz player, more than a classical player, is trained to recognize these things straight away, really. So in terms of jazz theory, I'm probably a bit of a beginner, but I do know the basics of it.
Gotcha. Before we dig into a couple more songs, let's talk a little bit about making the book. How long did a project like this take you to from start to finish?
Right. Well, the thing is, these ideas for the book really have been floating around in my head maybe for 10 or 20 years. I mean, it might surprise you to know that I actually started the book in about March this year and finished it in July, and it's 120,000 words
wow,
long.
Wow.
But what I've got a very patient partner. She's actually sitting in the room listening to this conversation now.
Right.
But what happened is, I'd come home and I come home a bit early because I mainly do supply teaching, which in the UK means that you do short-term assignments. We don't have as many much marking to do. I do teaching in a day.
Okay.
So when I came home, I try and do one song a night, and there's 80 songs in there, and maybe each song is maybe just over 1,000 words long. So I'd maybe spend a couple of hours in the night, type with the headphones on, like, yeah, and listen to it, with the guitar out, trying to work things out, and I try and do one song a night. Then in the morning, I'd wake up maybe about 6, 7 o'clock, and try and finish off what I didn't do the night before. And then after I'd done all that, and I'd got maybe written 100,000 words or so, when I did the introduction and all the other stuff you need to do, like the appendix and the glossary, because I thought glossary is very important, you know, trying to explain
right.
some technical terms. And then it
right.
took me about 4 or 5 weeks of editing as well. This isn't the first book I've done. I've done music books as well, you know, with notation in it.
Right.
But I did realise with any book that nobody is ever too big to need an editor. So what I did is on Facebook, I said, does anybody want to edit maybe 10,000 words of a free book? So I had a team of people who were editing and spotting these mistakes for me. So that took about 5 weeks to try and iron out all of these glitches. And I know there might be the odd one or two, but I think it's a pretty accurate book now, you know,
yeah.
because we spent about 4 or 5 weeks editing it.
Yeah, I actually had
gotcha.
To follow up to that a little bit. I'm curious on the publishing aspect of it, Adrian. Did you find much trouble or support
yeah.
from the publishers pitching a book of this analysis and this in-depth work of McCartney's solo career. Did you have support from your publishers? Did you have to convince them that a book that was warranted of this nature, or no?
No, it's self-published, completely self-published. So, oh. I mean, I must admit, I'm a bit selfish, just like to have them. Self-publishing was a byword for low quality, but I don't think you can save it anymore because there are actually some advantages to it, because 50% of the books sold around the world now are on Amazon. So right. You've already got 50% of the market of the world if you can get it on Amazon. So I knew how to... There's certain standards you have to adhere to get it on Amazon. I just won't let everything on it. But because I've published other books before, I knew what standards and what thresholds I have to pass to get it onto Amazon in terms of all of the details and all the formatting and everything. Yeah. And I just wanted complete control over it. And I have tried publishing with other people before, because I've published sheet music books. And I was let down once, and it put me off a bit, because somebody said, oh, I'll publish it for you. And then I wrote the whole book, and then I never heard from him again. So that put me off. And I just thought, well, there's no need for that. I can just do it myself. And as long as I've got people who I can really trust who have skilled music, because for my sheet music books, I've got a friend in Scotland who's a really skilled musician, and he's checked it. I know if he's checked it's okay.
Oh, cool. That's really cool that you can actually self-publish like that. What it makes things easy to do it yourself, you know?
Well, I think that's becoming a trend now, especially with Beatle books out there. I believe the crew for A is for Apple that's being done in Germany. I believe they're self-publishing, and Jude Kessler, who's doing that the John Lennon series, I believe she's self-publishing herself. Mm-hmm. So it's not rare anymore that these books are working on their own. You're printing the pages, you're putting the book together. I mean, that's something that's going to somewhere else for them to put this book together, though, right?
So just repeat it once more. It just broke
okay,
up a
so
bit.
Yeah, the putting the book together, the actual book together itself, I mean, where does that go for people to, do somebody else print the pages and bind the book? I mean, how does that process work?
Okay, packages you've got. So basically what you have to do is you have to have it in a... And I started off in a Word format, then I converted it to PDF. So I needed a good PDF editor, because there's certain things you can't do on Word, which you can do on PDF. So once you've got the PDF ready, and you've added... I designed the cover myself as well on Publisher. All the photographs have been kindly donated by friends and colleagues on Facebook, and people I've known are big McCartney fans. So I didn't know enough about formatting from the other books. So once you've gone on to Lulu and you've made an account and everything, you've got to basically submit your PDF documents, and you've got to submit also your cover design documents as well.
Okay.
And then the rest is left to them. And it's what you call print on demand, which means that a book is only normally printed if somebody's put an order for it. But I do notice Amazon... If Amazon thinks a book is selling well, even if it's print on demand, they will always have a few books, print on demand books, printed and waiting. So if you go on Amazon and look up this book, it will say something like 13 books remaining or something like that, which means they've printed a few so they can pick them off the shelf.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so that's how it works, basically. It's print on demand.
Gotcha. Cool. You know, Andy, one of Kenneth Womack's books, it's called I Am Lucy Lemonade, I believe, some title. That's the same thing, too. I think that's how it's a print on demand. So so he just doesn't write Beatle books. He's also, writing other stuff as well. But let's get into... we had talked before, and you had mentioned that you also tried to get a few of the musicians, but... didn't have any luck talking with, was it Denny Lane you tried to get for the book?
I did put out a message to Denny, but the answer was that he'd been misquoted in a few books. I think he did a book called Blackbird,
Jeffrey Giuliano. Yeah.
He's a very controversial figure. And
yes.
And there are, he's obviously, I think one of the reasons for the fallout with McCartney was some of the stuff that was published in the press and at the time in the early 80s. And I think the story was that Denny Lane was doing an interview for a biography. And then rather than it being in a biography, some newspaper just decided to print it all. I mean, I did try, and the thing is with Denny, you've got to go through, I think it's his girlfriend or partner was like the intermediary, but
All right.
she said he's been misquoted a few times. I did try and persuade him that this is a book just about the music. There's not any gossip in it at all. I'm just not interested in that side to it. But so
Gotcha.
I didn't get anywhere with that, but that's fair enough. I'm hoping that if I do a second volume, then I will be able to say to people, now you can see what the first volume's about.
Right.
There's no gossip in there at all. It's just purely about the music. Would you be interested in helping me to contribute some ideas about the second volume?
Okay.
So I might try and make some contacts again for when I do the second volume. But it didn't really matter too much because I still think the book was okay about the interviews, you know. And what happened in the end was the book was getting so big, I thought I've got to stop there after 80 songs because after it. It's about, I know I've given you the paperback version, but I've got
Yeah.
the hardback version here. And the
Right.
hardback version is 436 pages because it's a smaller format.
Okay.
And if you start making it too big, then people don't want to spend too much money on it. So I thought that was a reasonable place to stop. And with interviews as well, it would have got even bigger still, wouldn't it?
Fair point.
Right,
Fair point.
right,
Yeah.
right. Why did you feel the need to dedicate this book to Linda McCartney?
I just, well, at home, we don't eat meat at home. So she's
Okay.
been a big, in yeah, she's been a big influence, really, from that viewpoint. And I think also in the world of pop music and the world of celebrity, it's very rare, especially nowadays, to meet somebody who's quite sincere and down to earth. And I've always admired the fact that she came from quite a rich, middle class New York background. But when
Right.
she met Paul McCartney, the thing that appealed to her most was that down-to-earth thing in Scotland, of living there in the Mull of Kintyre. So she actually went the opposite, and she wanted to live in a very stripped-down version of living in Scotland. And I think it's great that she had that approach to life, really. And also, I've known people who have known Linda McCartney and said she's, you know, a really lovely person, very approachable, no airs and graces. And for that reason, she's inspirational to a lot of people, and I also think she's made Paul McCartney the person he is, and undoubtedly she must have had a major effect on his songwriting as well, and all the songs which she inspired from him, and some of the themes in the songs as well, like songs about the environment and
Right.
vegetarianism. They were definitely inspired by his relationship with Linda McCartney, and she'd be the first to admit she wasn't the world's best musician.
Right.
But she definitely had an enormous effect on these songs throughout that period.
Right. It's really hard to imagine after listening to these songs for so long now, it would be really hard to imagine her, her not being, there, her vocals not there. I mean, it
Yeah.
just I don't I couldn't. I don't think I could listen to these songs now without her
No,
involvement. You know what I mean?
she
You know.
contribute she contributed a key a sound
Yeah.
to the Wings sound. And Denny Laine said as much in the Band on the Run 25th anniversary that she was criticized and people liked to make fun of her because of what she wore and how she dressed and what she did. But nobody's going to say that she's the world's greatest singer. Clearly, she wasn't, but she was the right fit for Wings, I think.
Right. Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Let's talk about the what else is in the book, the how to use beginner's guide. I mean, things like these are common in books like these where, especially when you're, using it as a musician's approach. I mean, this book is basically mainly probably just for musicians that want to learn these songs.
Well, I designed it really for musicians who wanted to understand a bit more of McCartney's music and maybe notice things they hadn't done before. But I also wanted it to be for a general listener who wanted it to improve understanding of some of the basic music terminology. So maybe if they've heard these things enough times that they'll be able to pick out some of these chords and some of these effects that you have in music, because some of these chords they do repeat themselves. Once you've heard that major seventh chord, you know that sound here, you'll hear it in other. You'll then you might if I've said that's a major seventh chord, then you'll hear undoubtedly hear an augmented chord like that. I mean, there's a Beatles song which starts with that. I don't know if you know which Beatles song that was on Abbey Road, but there's a song on Abbey Road that starts with that very augmented chord. Any ideas? Oh, darling, starts with an augmented chord.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I just think it's just interesting to learn these things, and then you make connections between different songs, and you just entertain your friends in the pub and say, "Did you know that this song starts with an augmented chord?" It's just a comp.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So we talked about My Love. So that's one from the 70s. Let's hop to the 80s and talk about song Pipes of Peace. What's unique about that song that made you want to add that to the book?
A favorite of mine, by the way, too, so thank you.
This is Pipes of Peace we're talking about now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah,
Pipes
we
of Peace,
talked
right?
about
Okay
My
then.
Love.
So, yeah. So what's interesting about Pipes of Peace that you work out is it's got. I've always said that one of the great things about McCartney is his attention to bass lines. A bass line isn't just notes plodding on in the background. To have a great bass line, it almost pulls the music forward because. Yeah. So, did you hear that?
Yeah.
So if Joe, so it goes from E, F sharp, G sharp, and over the top of that, it's pulling in the direction he adds a melody. Ben. He adds this bit of musical spice there. Now, musical spice, rather than just a boring chord, it's what's called a diminished chord. It's a point of tension in it, in the music. It's sort of that sound chord there sounds a bit unusual, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Right.
Sounds a bit off key, yeah? So he uses that there, if you just freeze it there, but then it's resolved. So the bass line's very important. It leads the song in a certain direction, and also you've got these spicy chords in it, like these diminished chords, which there was actually a meme on a classical music page on Facebook a few weeks ago. It was about can you name a pop song with a diminished chord in, and a few people came up with some. So it's just something about it's just adding a bit of spice into the mix, really, and having something that's interesting in it. And there's other stuff you can say about as Pipes of Peace as well. We just found it here. So the other interesting thing about it is that you've got something called an interrupted cadence, which I explained about a chord of B7. You expect it to go to E like that. Now at the end of the verse, it goes. No, you expect it to go to E, which sounds logically it's going to go to the chord of E, but you go.
Okay.
It goes into C all around the world, it goes into that
Right.
bit. And what it is it's a really throws for listening. It creates this magical moment. It's what the classical musicians know as an interrupted cadence, is a junction between two parts of a song. And you normally expect it to go from B7 back to E, and it's all finished and all nicey nicey. But instead of doing that, it froze into. And it creates. So it's like opening a window onto a whole different. Taking us into a whole different place. So then it goes all around the world, little children being for in the world. Yeah, so it goes into that new place there. But it's not just about the chords in Pipes of Peace, it's about the complexity of the arrangements as well. There's
Okay.
a video on YouTube you can see, which where Russell Harty's chat show host in Britain called Russell Harty talking
Yeah.
about the Pipes of Peace. And there's about, the thing he says is something like about 40 or 60 channels there, all these different tracks interweaved together. So there's a tabla in there, the Indian percussion instrument, which comes in that section. There's a children's choir there as
Yeah.
well. He actually gets the children's choir, not a trained children's choir, but one which is just about 10 miles away from his house in East Sussex. He actually asked them to be on the recording, and it's like a choir for refugee children. So a lot of people don't realize this. So there's like a real powerful symbol of this refugee choir there on the song as well, his children's choir. And it's all these levels of instrumentation, and it's what you'd expect from a typical George Martin production. It's very grandiose, isn't it? And at the end of the song as well, it finishes on a chord of E just after it goes to A minor. And it ends on this very bright chord of E, and it's like almost a note of positivity. He could have ended on an E minor, like a sad chord, but he's ended on this positive chord, you know. And it's a beautiful song, and it really concludes a song in a positive way. It's like a note of optimism.
Yeah, right. I think Russell, wasn't Russell in the studio too? I think during the mixing of that song too, Russell Hardy, or as Russell Heartless, as Mecca calls him.
Yeah.
What's does this, I mean, obviously you wrote a book about that, I mean, does this impress you more than his songwriting ability? I mean, lyrically, does the chords and all the notes, I mean, does this impress you more than his, you know, his lyrics? I mean, what do you think about his lyrics in general?
I was limited to an extent to the lyrics I could quote in the book, because obviously you can quote chord sequences to describe chords, but as soon as you start quoting lyrics, you run into copyright problems.
Right.
So I'd only quoted about three lyrics at a time. I mean, the lyrics there are, people can look up and just Google, and it's our love. And people have criticised McCartney's lyrics, but I think that the lyrics to Pipes of Peace are exceptionally good. And in terms of songwriting, it really isn't just about a melody. It's about the interaction of the bass line and the direction the bass line gives. It's all about the piano chords, and it's about all of these amazing textures that George Martin and Paul McCartney have worked together to bring it into the song. And it creates this fusion of different cultures, like the Indian culture and the children's choir all joining together. And that's why... That's why it was McCartney's only British number one solo hit.
Didn't it also, Adrian, didn't it also win an Ivor Novello, also, that song?
Was that due to the video?
Was it the, I don't know if it was the video, because of the one, I thought it did win an Ivor Novello award. But I don't
maybe,
know.
I'm not sure, I'd have to look it up. Yeah, but the video as well is an amazing.
Oh, it's a very groundbreaking video. Yeah, it's I remember that very well. I remember it being played, the whole thing, because there was that little introduction piece, the little mini, introduction before the song actually starts. I remember it premiering on MTV here, and. I was very moved by the video. It's great.
I don't
song
think. Yeah, I don't think it did too. I don't think it was a number one in this country. It might have.
No. But I saw the video. Right. They played the video here. I mean, over here it was so bad. Was the A side?
It was the A side?
Right. And I think in the UK, so bad was the B side, over there. If I remember correctly.
Yeah, it's always mystifies me. Apparently, Once Upon a Long Ago wasn't even released in America.
Correct.
No,
I mean,
it wasn't.
Some of these things are just very surprising, really, aren't they? You know, why they made that choice, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing how sometimes, well, because, you know, Backseat of My Car, I think that was a single in the UK, but it wasn't a single
here
in the States.
Wasn't a single here. No, it was not.
Yeah.
The choice always mystifies you, why they decide what's good for a certain market. I mean, that wouldn't even be heard of now, you know.
Right. I mean, Once Upon a Long Ago is one of your favorite songs, right, Andy?
Absolutely. It's probably my first. It's my favorite song, single. That A and I. We talked about this in my introductory show. Mm. It's that single, A B side, is my favorite two songs, really.
Yeah.
Now, Get Ourselves is an amazing piece of production, and I do go into the different layers of harmony and instrumentation and that. There's so many things there you don't notice. I took a long time listening to it with headphones on, trying to pick out all the different instruments and all the different layers. And apparently that song was originally intended for Freddie Mercury, I believe.
Yeah, correct.
I don't know if that's ever been confirmed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I couldn't imagine Freddie singing that one, though.
Well, I thought it was more the... I thought it was going to be more of a duet than just giving it to...
the two of them?
I thought it was... That was the original story, was it would... You know, they were going to work on the song together. But he just ended up being too busy and he wasn't able to do the song.
I think he made the wise choice.
It's a great standalone McCartney song for sure. So we talked about Price of Peace there from the 80s. Let's go into the 90s a little bit and talk Little Willow, which is one of the great tracks from Flaming Pie.
Yeah, and we were talking about the difference between McCartney and Lennon. And Lennon often liked to double track his voice and have lots of thick instrumentation. But on songs like Little Willow, McCartney's, it's total opposite Pipes of Peace. It's very stripped down arrangements, isn't it? Very simple, just piano and guitar, really. And you can't imagine anything more simple. But I think what's clever about it is the simplicity of it. And it just starts off like this. Just through those two simple chords, just set the atmosphere so beautifully, don't they? Yeah, and then when the tune starts, right, like that. Now, I've actually bought a prop to show you here because this is my way of thinking about it. Because this stick here is the willow. Like that. And it goes to the tone like da 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 da. It's almost like you're hearing this da 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 da. You know what I mean?
Interesting.
You're hearing
Right.
that tension, and it's almost like a metaphorical picture of a willow being bent. To me, anyway, it starts on the fifth note, da, 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 and it goes back to the tonic. And to me, that's what it represents, and I think that's amazing. You know, it starts like that. So it starts off because it's actually the fifth note of a scale. So you've got a chord of D, but it goes down to the tonic note. So each bit of it goes on that. And it's a feeling of suspension. It's almost like you're trapped in this because these two chords, it stays on that for. Now, I don't know if you notice, the bass note is the same all the way, all the time. It's just D. Then suddenly goes to G. When it goes, nothing's going to shake your love. And when you get that release from the D to the G, it's this sudden release from the tension. That's a bit of a magical moment for me when it goes and then the bass chord, it's like ends on that word hey, and you've got what you call a double suspension here. You've got that note of G, which is G, but we've got a what you call a sus four, an A sus four chord. So there's just a great effect there, and that's what you call a dominant chord. So leave hey, then it goes hey, then it goes back into the D again. So just this great moment of suspension there before it goes back into the first again. And I think that second time through as well, you've got a doubled-up harpsichord in the background. If you look at Paul McCartney's home studio when you see it being filmed for an East Sussex, he's got a spinet, I think, hasn't he? Or a harpsichord. Have you seen that in his studio?
Yeah,
You
in the
know that old
documentary, in the Flaming
that
Pie documentary. Yeah.
yeah that tinkly old. I think he actually says he's got some of these old instruments at Abbey Road were thrown away, or and he just said, "Oh, I'll have that,"
He
you know,
just
rather
took
than
them all,
get rid
yeah.
of it. Maybe the Mellotron comes from Abbey Road as well. I'm not sure, but to create an interesting texture next time it comes round as well. He does the voice up an octave. His vocals go up an octave. I can't sing that high, actually. It's a note. It's a note of A, what you call A4. But he goes, "Sleep, little willow," but it's an octave above that. And he's got his doubled up harpsichord in the background as well. So it's that lovely texture as well that he creates. But I think you've got to say that lyrically, that's one of the most amazing lyrics he's produced in
I
his career.
agree.
Even though the music isn't really about, even though the book I've written isn't really primarily about the words, but it's to have a metaphor off a willow tree, because willow is typically bendy, to be able to bend away, because he's not saying, "Let's just forget about the troubles of life," or "Let's all start grieving," or "Go into funeral mode." Let's just try and use, let's just use this as a metaphor for how we have to swerve and avoid these troubles that life inevitably sends our way. And what an amazing thing to give to family of Maureen Starkey, or whatever she was called at that point. It's a tribute to her mum, very heartfelt tribute.
I think that record, just to follow up, Flaming Pie has a lot of those themes in it, because obviously Linda was dying at the time, and Little Willow, of course, and Calico Skies, and even Great Day. There's a lot of themes of sadness in a way that kind of permeate through that album. Obviously, there's moments of joy on it, but I do think that is obviously, for me, that's a dividing line for McCartney's career, before Linda and after Linda. Obviously, his life changed so much, but that really is a dividing line for me in terms of how he carried himself, really from that point on. And he did such a great job with all the songs on that album, Beautiful Night, Little Willow, just wonderfully crafted music to really bookend and really put an end to the end era of Paul and Linda, sadly.
Yeah, if you see the video of him playing Calico Skies on Logfire playing that, and then he's with Linda in the studio, it's a completely heartbreaking incident to know what by that stage what she was going through. And I remember watching that, and I think the whole of that video in the world tonight is probably one of the best. If I was to give somebody a video to sort of convert them into liking Paul McCartney, I'd probably give them that video. It's an amazing
Absolutely.
portrayal, really, of his work and that era. The song just sounds so sincere and heartfelt. I was interested to learn that some of these songs, like Some Days is the other one, which has got a melancholic feel in it. I did think that if you actually looked at the chronology of it was written, I think we found out, before Linda's diagnosis of cancer, that it was written before that. But maybe once he brought it into the studio and started mixing, recording it, then maybe some of the atmosphere of that stage in his life went into the mixing and the way it was arranged, or whatever, And also the arrangement by George Martin on Some Days is a masterpiece of orchestration. It's complete opposite of Pipes of Peace. It's got very understated
Very understated. I
parts.
Was just going to say that. Very
for
understated
solo,
production.
For solo instruments rather than a massive orchestra, which you might expect from some of George Martin's orchestrations. It's all about just little solo instruments having almost like a heartfelt conversation. So it's the one of his definitely one of his outstanding albums, that.
It's weird because if you get the McCartney Years box set with all of his videos, there's a video for Little Willow, but yet it wasn't released as a single anywhere, I don't believe. So, I mean, I was always curious about why would he do a video for the song, but I think you mentioned it earlier where this was a gift for Maureen's family. So maybe this was the video went along with the song as well as a gift, but just also included the video on that DVD box set. So, but I mean, it's a lovely video. I don't know if you've seen, I mean, I take it you've probably seen the video as well.
This is the one of a family. It's like a family video and stuff, an imaginary family. That's nice. I also just like to see him. Just like to see him playing it also, because there's one with him. I think again with is it with Linda in his East Sussex studio on that in the World Tonight video. I think that's you could, there's a complete version of him doing it with her as well, I think.
Well, we might get all that stuff in the forthcoming Flaming Pie archive set if that's indeed the next one.
Yeah, I hope so. Doing a project like this by yourself, what advice would you give up and coming or inspiring authors that want to get something out? Like, what kind of advice would you give them to do a project like you did?
Oh, saying advice to other people who wanted to do
Yeah,
a similar thing.
right. Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't dive into doing something like I've done unless you've done something smaller scale to begin with. I have done nine other books, music, so I was fairly confident, and I knew the subjects well enough, and I think confidence is one thing, but one of the key things really is to start small. Don't start off with a book that's 120,000 words long. Do maybe 20,000 words, just about one per aspect of something you're interested in. And then the most important advice of it all really is don't, even if you've got a PhD in English language, don't trust yourself to edit your own work. You've
No.
got to have other people. other people on board, because you know yourself that you've written something on a Word document. The second you send it to a printer and print it out, you notice there's a mistake in it. Even when I've converted some things from Words, even when I've converted from Word to PDF, for some obscure reason, when you see it on PDF, you'll notice there's a mistake you didn't notice on Word. And there must be some like psychological reason for this, but you become blind to your own mistakes. So the editing is such an essential part of it, you know.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I just have one final question for him. Adrian, this is kind of a polarizing question, but why do you think that there hasn't been, I mean, there's been so much written about the Beatles, as you talked about in your introduction. There's so many books. There's so many McCartney books, biography books, but there's not too many books that delve into the actual musical analysis of his post-Beatles work. Why do you think that is? And is that, was that one of the reasons why you decided to write this book, because there was simply nothing else out there?
Yeah, that was definitely one of the main motivations. There is actually another book, and I think there was one more a book which is a bit similar to mine. I think we spoke about it last time, didn't we? Let me just tell the
Benitez book, maybe.
Yeah, I think
it's called
Words and Music.
Just a minute. Here's some. I'm just looking at the thing. Here we have. It's Vincent Perez Benitez. Words of Music and Paul McCartney's solo years. So that book, but it tries to do every single song, and I just think it just glosses over them too quickly.
Agreed.
Okay.
You're asking me why there hasn't been. I think there's definitely a commercial reason. I sat at a Beatles convention in Liverpool and over in August, and I did notice that Beatles books do sell a lot more than Paul McCartney or solo books, because people get into the Beatles first. So I'm imagining that if you're a normal publisher, you're going to first of all want people to write a Beatles book because it's going to sell a lot more. So that's a commercial reason for it.
Right.
But I just think that we have had a few Beatles books like that where they've gone over the Beatles career and taking an approach to the songwriting aspects of it. There's one by Dominic Pedler, have you heard of that book?
Yes.
A songwriting sequence of the Beatles. That's very good, but it doesn't take a song by song approach. It takes actually a topic by topic approach, which will have a chapter on something like double plagal cadences, which is quite an abstract way of organizing it. So I do actually think there's room for a book about the Beatles to take the approach I've taken as well. I have thought about doing one about the Beatles, but I think there's definitely a commercial reason for it. And I've got to say as well, without putting myself on too much of a higher pedestal, there aren't maybe that many people who know a lot about Paul McCartney's solo career and are confident to write that book, and also have a musical background as well to write that book. I mean, there are a lot of fans out there who do know probably more than I do about Paul McCartney's solo career, like maybe you two do. But I've got a confidence also in the technical side of things as well. So without blowing my own trumpet, I did know that I'd be able to write this book because I've got this natural interest in Paul McCartney.
Right.
And unlike some other people, maybe Philip Norman had like a whole file full of notes he's taken, but a lot of his information, I've had to check some dates because I'm a fan and I listen to the things and read about things on a daily basis. A lot of the information was in my head, really, so I didn't really have to get loads of book sales and loads of reference manuals like I was writing a PhD and cross-reference everything, because I just knew that this had an idea. And when I needed to check dates and so on, I checked the dates. So I just think you need to have somebody who's got a knowledge and actual affinity to Paul McCartney's career, solo career, and also some knowledge of music theory as well.
Right. You know, I think it's important that we get this aspect of Paul's career out there. I mean, everybody knows the lyrics, it's our hardcore fans, but not everybody knows this side of Paul. And I think this is a great thing that you've done is to you know, go to that side and, you know, break down these songs.
Go ahead. I also want to say I've just set the ball rolling, really, because I just each essay, each like a mini essay, is only about 1,000 words long. If I wanted to wanted to, or somebody else wanted to, they could write probably 10,000 words on each song. I'm just giving people a few pointers that they might be interested in, things they might not have noticed before. There's no limit to, if you're really that interested, you might want to really strip it apart more. And I think I said last time to you that I believe somebody's written a PhD of 1,000 words or thereabouts just about Bohemian Rhapsody.
Right.
So if you want to take it apart to that extent, you can do that.
Right.
But I didn't want to write that. I just wanted to write a fairly accessible book, which would just make people appreciate some things in the songs that maybe they hadn't noticed. And also I hadn't noticed before, because it was a learning process for me to sit down and work out some of these bass lines and listen to things I've not heard before and find out what was going on and what keys and all these different chords. So I found out a lot as well from doing it.
Right. So you mentioned earlier about doing a sequel. What are the guidelines for that? When do you think you'll start working on it?
When's part two coming out? We need part two.
Yeah, well, actually, as a part-time, I teach in a day, but I'm doing a master's course in Scottish history as well.
So that's so you're occupying.
Busy. Yeah, that's occupying my time.
Right.
Boring textbooks to read about that as well, because I'm interested. History is actually an interest of mine, but music is my passion, so I'm interested in both things. And actually doing the history course, it helped my writing style as well, because when you're writing a lot, you get into the zone of writing more. So I'm hopefully after Christmas, I've done that unit for that course. I'm going to start in earnest after Christmas to do the second volume of it. And I'm going to do some more songs which haven't hardly been looked at before. Like, for example, Did We Meet Somewhere Before? It's a very interesting song. And that starts with a major seven chord, actually, and that's got a clarinet introduction, which not many pop songs have got an extended clarinet introduction in.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's lots of interesting things to talk about, and lots of interesting songs. I think I'm happy to do another 80 songs, which I think are either good or great, and I want to keep the book positive. There's some fans who like absolutely everything that he's ever done. I've got to be honest, there's some things I really don't like that he's done, and I'm not going to do those songs without mentioning some of those songs.
All right.
I think there's another 80 songs I can do, which I mean, to start after Christmas, and as long as I can fit it in with other jobs I'm doing in the house, I hope to have it ready by the summer.
Right. I'm sure you got the honeydew list as well, too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I've got. It can take over your life a bit, but you've got to be disciplined, haven't you? You know.
Of course, of course. So remind people where they can get the book, and do you have any other appearances planned where people can meet you and talk to you about this book?
I don't have. Basically, I've done this podcast here with you. I've done another one, which you can find on SoundCloud as well. I did an interview. I went to Merseyside 2 weeks ago to meet Spencer Lee. I don't know if you know Spencer.
I know Spencer quite well, actually. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. So I went to the recording studios in Merseyside and met with Billy Kingsley 2 weeks ago now on Sunday, and we did an hour talking about this book and other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You can find that interview still on the BBC Merseyside website.
Great.
It's called On the Beat. It's Spencer Lee's thing, so you can find that about. And if anybody else is interested in me doing a podcast or anything, or an interview, or wants me to explain any aspects in the book, then the fans will contact me, because I want it to be a two-way process, really. I put my email address in the book. So it's a hobby of mine. It's not just a way of making money for me at all. You know, it's just if anything, it's just a bit of extra pocket money or grocery bill. You know, the money I'm doing from this. So if anybody wants to contact me about anything to do with the book or anything, they want to know any interviews they want to do with me, they can do. If you want to buy the book, the best place to buy it from is Lulu. .com. If you actually go to Lulu's website where the book is made, you're guaranteed a really high quality production of it. Obviously, Amazon, the prints, basically what happens, Amazon will get the PDF and print their own. The quality is still pretty good from Amazon, but Lulu, we've got some of the best printing presses in the world. And
Okay.
obviously, I'm gonna
Is the
and
it's just real quick, is the hard copy is a
yeah.
hard copy version available from Lulu, or is that only on
Yes.
Amazon? Yeah.
For the hard copy thing seems to be saying it's almost not available yet on Amazon, which
Oh.
I'm going to look into why that is. But
Right.
or it says order now and get in a week or something like that. I'm going to follow that up why that is. It's definitely available on Lulu. It's exactly the same price. It just
Okay.
with basically with you get it from Lulu. Also cuts out the middleman as well because
Right.
Amazon obviously is taking their cut as well, you know.
Yeah, so you're probably making more of a profit from selling it from Lulu than you are on Amazon, which
Yeah, but obviously I am. But
Right.
most of the traffic, most of the book traffic in the world is obviously
Yeah.
driven through Amazon, and for that
True.
reason,
Right.
they do take their cut from it, and that's just how it
Right.
is.
And that
Right.
website is just lulu.com?
If you just put the name of the book, which is obviously Paul McCartney after the Beatles and a musical appreciation, then put lulu.com or just Lulu, you'll get the link to that book. And the
Okay.
difference is a hardback as well has got some extra photographs. The guy who used to service the telephones at Paul McCartney's Mullaghcleugh residence actually met Paul McCartney and took some photographs of Paul McCartney's farm. And there's a picture of is it Higher Ranch or something, one of his recording studios there.
Oh,
Give me some
Spirit of
photographs of that.
Rincon. Yeah.
Yeah, that one, yeah. He's given me
Okay.
some photographs of that. There's a photograph of him meeting Paul McCartney. There's
Nice.
a few more. There's a few more photographs from James and Tom Liverani. I don't know if you know those two, but they're on Facebook quite a lot. And met Paul McCartney and taken a few photographs. So there's just a few extra photos in the hardback
Gotcha.
edition, you know.
Great. Awesome. Well, we'll put those links on when we post the show. We'll put those links on there. We'll make sure people know where they
Absolutely.
can where they can get the book. And you know, been promoting the book as much as I can. Again, this
Okay.
is Paul McCartney After the Beatles, a musical appreciation. I think it's great. I wish you many, success with this book and many more successes with whatever projects you're going to do in the future regarding Paul McCartney. You have anytime you would like to come on and promote future projects, we would love to have you on the show and help you, get the word out, because we love all as much information as we can get on McCartney. We're all for it.
Yeah, and
So
th Adrian,
thank
Adrian, thank you for bringing
you.
much needed attention to a subject area that has been grossly overlooked for the better part of 50 years. So thank you.
Thank
So
you.
anyways,
Thanks for
you
asking
got
me on. That's been great.
right. So once again, this has been another edition of Two Legs, the Paul McCartney podcast. Andy, you got anything you want to plug away, or
Not much.
what's going on?
We'll have this up in a couple of days, and you can find me on Facebook, Andy Nichols, Two Legs. We have our Instagram pages too and accounts, and you can connect me anyway, andynichols@gmail.com. Drop me a line. Anything you want to say or suggest, that's where you can find me.
Great. And then we have our email address, twolegspodcast@gmail.com. We're on YouTube now. This has been recorded on video, so I'm proud to say that we're doing video cast now. You can head over to our channel, Two Legs Podcast. Please subscribe, then you'll find out when other so you can find out when videos are posted. We have our Facebook page, Two Legs, a Paul McCartney Podcast. Check us out there. And like Andy said, we have Instagram, we have Twitter at Two Legs Podcast. I'm Tom Hunyadi. For Annie Nichols, for Adrian Allen. Have a great day and a beautiful night. Thank you.
See you next time.
You've been listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan C.